Good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
And good morning. It's Monday, the 5th of August. You're listening to 101.9 High FM. And my name is Nicholas Ingle. It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday. We have a fantastic guest for you today, and that's Dr. Robert Brayman, and he is the director of the new Infectious Disease and Oncology Research Institute at the University of Witwatersrand. We're going to be chatting to him about cancer and its relationship to infectious diseases. So let us have your questions or comments on our WhatsApp number in studio, 061-895-1019.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
It's Monday, just gone 10 past 10, and that means it's time for the Dis-Chem Medical Monday. I'm your host, Nicholas Ingle, and you're listening to 101.9 High FM. We are joined by Dr. Robert Brayman, Director of New Infectious Diseases and Oncology Research Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand. Doc, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Nick, for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I think such an important topic to discuss as well. And so I just wanted to start off, what is the Infectious Disease and Oncology Research Institute at WITS?
Sure. Thank you, Nick. So first of all, at WITS, obviously I'm an American, and I've wound up here at WITS, and it's a great honor to be here to get this new institute going, which has been in the works for a couple of years now. And the idea is that there is world-class, truly world-class infectious disease work that occurs here at WITS. You know, South Africa itself has a number of universities that do infectious disease science that could compete with any university in the world. And WITS is way up on the top. And so the idea initially was to integrate infectious disease work that's occurring in many different, you know, labs and in teams, and bring them together and be stronger, have more innovative, collaborative work. And then also to integrate the cancer work that occurs here, which is certainly at the top in Africa for doing cancer research. But the real unique feature is putting those two integrated parts together, infectious disease work, cancer work, putting them together, and that overlap, that intersect, is remarkably unique. There's no institute in the world that does that. And it's a very important connection, because by finding an infectious disease linked to cancer, you can prevent it more easily, you can diagnose it easily, and there's a potential for treatment that could leapfrog over traditional conventional methods of managing cancer, many of which are not available here in Africa.
Right. How did the research institute come to be? What was the catalyst?
Yeah, well, there was a great deal of interest in integrating those two disciplines here. And the dean here, whose name is Shabir Mahdi, had that vision to put them together and see what unique results come out of this.
Right. So, and for yourself, how did you get into research? What made you choose that path in medicine?
Yeah. Well, that's a long story, of course, but my interest initially was working in the laboratory. So I did an infectious disease fellowship at UCLA, which is in Los Angeles in the West Coast of the U.S. and enjoyed my time in the lab, but felt it was a little too confining for me, and I sought to do something different. So I took a position at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control as an epidemiologist there, and I was there for 26 years. My time at CDC included 13 years in Kenya, where I started a new program there on emerging infections, and then 4 years before that in Bangladesh, also starting a new research program there, both of which are thriving today. But my focus has really been on inequities and using science to address massive inequities that exist in the world. So you have cancers, for instance, in the U.S. that used to be untreatable that now are largely treatable. People survive. But those treatments are not available in Africa, for instance. And so I've always been driven to use science to kind of level the playing field and address those kinds of inequities. So when I was asked by Dean Mahdi to come here, I was based in Atlanta at that time at Emory University. I thought about it, wasn't sure, and then looked at the situation more closely here, looked at the high quality of work that comes from WITS and elsewhere here, and thought, and also looked at the uniqueness of the idea. There's nothing, no institute like this in the world. I thought, I should do this.
Fantastic. What is it that makes WITS so unique worldwide?
Yeah, it's, you know, first of all, there's a tremendous history here, you know, that goes back to the really early part of the 20th century, and certainly in the last half of the 20th century, some of the most important science in the area of respiratory diseases, in other infectious diseases, and also in cancer research. And a variety of other fields, including non-scientific fields, came from WITS. So there's a great scientific tradition here. It's a very proud history that continues to be enhanced and strengthened. And there's leadership here that is very strong. The VC, the vice chancellor here, is a huge supporter of what we're doing. As is the overall, the deputy vice chancellor for research. And having leadership, you know, at the top support this kind of, you know, first of its kind institute is really key to success.
Absolutely. What are the correlations now? We spoke about the connection between cancer research and infectious disease research at WITS. What is the correlations that we're seeing between cancer and infectious diseases?
Yeah. For me, I think the poster boy for all this is back in the 1980s, a German researcher named Zurhausen was convinced that cervical cancer was caused by a virus. And nearly everyone thought that was ridiculous. And he went through a tremendous amount of resistance, a headwind as he researched that. But as he studied it more closely, identifying human papillomavirus as HPV, as what looked like to be a facilitator for cancer and cervical cancer in particular, he gained some steam and some support. It took a long time and a heck of a lot of persistence. But now, you know, we're at a point where the WHO, the World Health Organization, Director General, now has made it a priority to eliminate cervical cancer as a public health problem through the use of an HPV vaccine. If I had suggested when I was in med school that you could prevent this cervical cancer, which really is a scourge, it's the number one cause of death here among women in South Africa due to cancer.
Wow.
Wow. If you know, if I was to say you could prevent that with a vaccine against some virus, I probably would have been thrown out of med school.
Right.
But here we are, where you can prevent cervical cancer as well in Brazzaville as you can in Beverly Hills. It's really remarkable. And there are a number of other examples like that, but that's the model. By the way, when Zurhausen got the Nobel Prize in 2008, the Nobel Prize committee focused less on the science and more on the persistence. And they focused on the fact that if it hadn't been for his headstrong approach, that this discovery would not have happened.
That's unbelievable. So I'd like to touch on that, Doctor, when we get back now. We're just going to do a short live read. Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics for Adults offer convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having your regular wellness check, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offer you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care. Find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside Dis-Chem Pharmacies. Better health starts here.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You are listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday here on 101.9 High FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and I'm joined in studio by Dr. Robert Brayman, Director of Infectious Diseases and Oncology Research Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand. Doctor, we were talking before we went to ads about sort of the how all of this started, the connection between the two. Just a question slightly off track. How much is tenacity of the researcher involved in discoveries? Because I think it's an incredible passion and understanding and commitment to keep pushing against, I suppose, the establishment.
It's a great question, Nick. You know, I think all successful scientists will have stories about how difficult it has been at times to get the resources, you know, the money, basically, to do the work that they want to do and explore the science in the way they want to explore it. And so all of us have experienced a bit of headwind. But I often think that the greater the discovery, the greater the headwind. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, all great truths begin as blasphemy.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic quote. So for you, where does the passion come from?
Yeah, you know, you only have one life, and it's like when you go camping, you want to leave the camping site cleaner than when you got there.
Right.
And with when you have an opportunity to do something useful in life, I think it's important to push on that and to do the most, have the work lead to the greatest good.
Yes.
And, but also, for a lot of people in science and for me as well, a lot of this is just curiosity. You know, you start with a question and you say, you know, what can I do about this? You know, what are the barriers to get to where we want to go?
Right.
And, you know, that leads to the scientific question, again, hopefully the funding, you wind up oftentimes with a discovery that leads to more discoveries, and that is it's addictive in a
right.
way.
Yes, and I think the effect is profound on the number of people positively, where perhaps working one-on-one, it's a one-on-one relationship that you have with your community, but research, the profound effects are global.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So how are the different – what has changed over the years where different research facilities and institutions, as you mentioned earlier, are starting to work together and to integrate their work and their research? What has brought on that change?
Yeah. It's a really, again, a very important question. I often say when I started doing infectious disease research back in the 80s, so I'm right. a bit of a dinosaur, early 80s, most of the big papers that would come out would have two or three authors. I remember my mentor in particular, who was kind of a world-class molecular immunologist. If there were more than three papers, more than three authors on a paper that he was part of, he would start to have an allergic reaction. He couldn't deal with that.
Right.
And these days, the important work that gets published in the high impact journals often have dozens, sometimes hundreds of co-authors, because what we've realized is that you're much stronger with, first of all, with larger population sizes, more right. Diverse populations that you can study issues in, study questions in ways that where the answers would be more representative. But also the other thing that drives this often is that the tools we use, the 21st century instrumentation, oftentimes is extremely expensive, and you work in a more efficient way if you have collaborators who have access to different, you know, cutting edge tools. You don't necessarily have to have them all yourself within your laboratory or right. within your university. So that really encourages a collaboration as well. But that's not to say that we don't also have competition in science. And so there, you need to choose your collaborator well. You need to make sure that you share the same goals and for the same outcome for the kind of outcomes that you're looking for.
Right.
And you know you do need to find people that work well together.
Okay. And then it also, with the cost of the equipment, the cost of laboratories, with collaboration that gives opportunities to medical researchers, perhaps from poorer countries, that don't have exactly. access to still contribute.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the question is how to democratize mm-hmm. science in the way that you're describing, Nick. And, you know, one of the things that's very interesting that we've been exploring is there's a new development of what are called cloud labs, where like cloud data, except it's laboratories, so that if you're in a country where you don't have access to any sophisticated equipment, you can send your specimens, the specimens you've collected from your study, your standard operating procedures for what you would do if you had the equipment in your laboratory, to a centralized lab that is often automated.
Right.
It will run your experiment. It will send you back your results almost in real time.
Wow.
And then you can go to the next, depending on the results, you can go to the next step and do the next experiment with specimens that have already been sent. So that really would democratize science in the way you're describing. At the moment, that process is expensive. And so these cloud labs that are emerging mostly in the North, in the United States and a bit in Europe, need to find a way to control their prices. But the concept is really great.
Right. That's an unbelievable concept, because I think sort of human ideas and when you know, that inspiration, if that's shared amongst more people, then there's greater opportunity for inspiration, I suppose.
And discovery.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Talking of discovery, I've got some information here. 800,000 new cancers are estimated to be discovered by 2050.
Yeah, I think that figure is for Africa.
Okay. Wow.
And that's on the rise, not necessarily because the risks for cancer are increasing, but the population of population is aging.
Yes.
And largely that's a marker of success because the infectious diseases that oftentimes killed children or people early in life are now being prevented or treated. And so people are living longer and advancing age is a risk factor itself for cancer.
Right.
But the proportion of those cancers that are due to infections, that are facilitated by infections, okay, that we already know about, is somewhere around 20%, 22% in some studies. But that's the ones we know about. We think there are many more. And so that proportion that are mediated by microbes is probably quite a bit higher.
Okay. What is the connection between infectious diseases and cancer? How are they triggering the cancers?
Yeah, so many different ways, actually. So the most, I think the simplest way that this happens for some cancers is through simply chronic infections causing chronic inflammation. That chronic inflammation can itself be a trigger for certain cancers. For instance, there's a parasite that's called Schistosoma hematobium that comes from lakes in Africa, also elsewhere, where there happen to be snails around. So Lake Victoria, for instance, Lake Malawi are high endemic areas for Schistosoma hematobium. And that parasite is a trigger for bladder cancer. That risk is largely due to chronic infection, chronic inflammation due to Schistosoma. In some cases, some of the viruses, including HPV, integrate with host cells and with host DNA. Cause a transformation of cells through direct interaction. And there's a variety of other mechanisms that occur depending on the microbe.
What can people do to manage infection or prevent infection? I think in Africa, I know nutrition is a problem. Hydration is a problem. What can people do to prevent as much as possible infections that can lead to these cancers?
Yeah. I mean, of course, going back to the lead example, young girls, and I feel also young boys, should be immunized with HPV. That's basically a cancer vaccine. And there are other cancers beyond cervical that can affect men and women. And so low-hanging fruit, make sure that everyone gets HPV vaccine and early before they're exposed to the virus. Other things like hepatitis B vaccine, chronic hepatitis B infection is associated, not everyone gets liver cancer, but there's, something on the order of 10% of those with chronic HPV, hepatitis B infection will develop liver cancer, totally preventable with giving hepatitis B vaccine early in life. It's a WHO recommendation to do that at birth, but it doesn't happen enough. And there's too many children, infants, and then children who go into their adulthood without having hepatitis B protection.
Right.
But you're right. In terms of general risk for cancer, there is good to keep a healthy weight. It is, likely that, other healthy behaviors, exercise and so on, decrease the risk. They won't prevent those things from happening. But what you're always trying to do is to manage your life in a way that the risks for these adverse events are minimized.
Right. How big a role does our immune system, the strength of our immune system, play in protecting us from these infections, particularly reoccurring infections.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons why this institute is so important here in South Africa is that HIV infection, which is sort of the example of virally induced immunosuppression, puts people at a much higher risk of a whole variety of cancers. And so that is an indication how important an intact immune system is. And the reason that people, as they advance in age, are at increased risk of cancer is due to what we call immunosenescence. In other words, the immune system, you know, itself ages and is not as effective. And so, yeah, it's immunity is really important. You know, it's not always totally clear what you can do to keep your immune function optimal. But, you know, again, those same common sense things like good nutrition, lifestyle, sleep, and so on are important. They're not absolute, but they can help.
So, you know, I know growing up in the early 70s, we were always told as kids, just go play outside, play in the sand, play. You might get worms, you might get sick, you know, going to school, getting sick, but that helps build a stronger immune system. So, you know, outdoors are quite important for younger kids as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So, perhaps a slightly difficult question, but given what has happened post-pandemic and with the views on vaccination, have you seen a decline in people wanting to vaccinate with their kids and for these different the different diseases?
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly the big fear, is that the anti-vaccine movement has sort of been fueled by the concerns that appeared globally around COVID vaccine. I think it's, you know, this is sort of a critical time to carefully reassess that question. Mm-hmm. And I think that community research, behavioral research, if you will, is going to be really important to understand this issue of what are the changing attitudes, what are the questions that are arising now about vaccines, and make sure that messaging and communication efforts address those concerns that parents have or adults have about taking a vaccine that might protect them.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a moving target. I think attitudes are changing, and it's important to understand what those are and be agile. The public health system needs to be agile and address those rising concerns. You know, again, vaccines are, you know, if you look at what they've been able to do over the last 80 some odd years, they're nothing short of miraculous. You know, when I grew up, everyone worried about polio.
Yes.
You know, everyone had a story about polio in the U.S. I remember my parents being very worried that their kids were going to develop that. And then just like that, you know, these two vaccines were introduced, and it's just not a concern anymore. And people, you know, the latest generation of people coming up now as parents don't have that history, don't know that.
Yes.
So they're not as likely to understand, you know, how miraculous these vaccines are. And you could go down the list of, you know, whooping cough and measles and tetanus and so on that are no longer real concerns that in the 20th century were major deals. I have a good friend who's a world-class vaccinologist, who's a pediatrician, and who likes to say the greatest assistance to training young pediatricians is the anti-vaccine movement, because he says that so many diseases that he trained on, that I trained on,
right,
you don't see anymore.
Yes.
But now, because of the anti-vaccine movement, they're coming back, and it's scary, really. But again, it's important that we understand what's driving that change in a real open-minded way, and come up with new strategies to make sure that, not to force parents or adults, but to make sure people really understand what's going on. And, you know, part of that is combating the disinformation and misinformation that's out there.
And Doc, we'll get on with that straight off to these ads.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
The Dis-Chem Medical Monday, and you're listening to 101.9 High FM. Let us have your questions in studio on our WhatsApp number, 061-895-1019. I'm chatting with Dr. Robert Brayman, Director of the new Infectious Disease and Oncology Research Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand. Doctor, before we went to break, we were chatting about vaccines and the anti-vaxxers and the effect that the pandemic had on people's relationships with vaccines. Information is probably the greatest weapon to understanding what goes on. And as you said so rightly, the older generation has seen firsthand the benefit and the value of vaccinations. With what are the area? What are the communities that your institute is working in within South Africa, within sub-Saharan Africa, and is there an education element?
Yeah, so the VITS has very interesting distribution in its hospital services, and also its community, its what we call population-based research and its community engagement. You know, the hospitals include an array of private hospitals, you know, like Donald Gordon, for instance, and world-class public hospitals like Chris Honey Baragwanath Gwynedd Hospital, there's none like it on the whole continent, probably really nothing like Baragwanath in the whole world in terms of its size and its expertise and the diversity of patients and so on. And also here at Charlotte Mekeke, it's hard for an American to say, is right next door to our med school, and is, you know, a major place for training our med students. So all of these hospitals are, Helen Joseph as well. And so there's a lot of research going on in each of these. In addition, there are community field operation or population-based field settings. The most famous one is what is called VITS Rural, which is off in the northeast part of the country, sort of adjacent to Kruger. And it's called the Agincourt research area. So that is a very active longitudinal, meaning they follow everyone, all the residents in that area, and work with them long term. And so it's really, you know, from the time that someone is born all the way through life stages and collecting information. There often are, you know, it's research that goes on there. And then there's also urban community sites, one operated by VITS RHI, which is led by Helen Rees, another world-class scientist and thought leader here in South Africa. And then there is another new urban informal settlement work that's being led by another group here at VITS. And so all of these are places where the finger is on the pulse. And I don't know if they are consistently looking at this question that you've asked about vaccine attitudes or attitudes about vaccination, but they could be. I mean, they're there for that sort of purpose. Right. And there are also places where you could test ideas. So what happens with, in my experience, with community engagement is you first do the focus group meetings, focus group interviews, and then key informant interviews, you know, leaders like community leaders, political leaders, and so on. Get your idea, get your knowledge about what the thinking is about a problem, and then devise a messaging strategy with them, talking, you know, going back and forth, a real bidirectional sort of co-design, and develop messaging that addresses their concerns, and then test that in another community. You know, does that address their concerns properly? And if not, why not? You know, what can you modify? So that's the approach.
What, can you tell us a little bit about some of the people that you are getting to work with, some of the researchers, the medical professionals?
Yeah, again, they're world class here. One of the groups that is, is an important part of ADORI. I mean, ADORI is the acronym for Infectious Disease and Oncology Research Institute. And there are a variety of fantastic scientists and scientific teams that are part of it. One of the groups is called the Antiviral and Gene Therapy Research Unit. It's AGTRU, and it's led by Patrick Arbuthnot. Patrick is a cutting-edge scientist who works in the area of hepatitis B infection and its chronicity, as well as its potential to cause things like liver cancer.
Right.
And he has been working on new vaccine approaches that would improve the already very effective hepatitis B vaccine, but make it easier to give and more effective and more have more duration to its immunoresponse. Antibodies would last longer.
Right.
And he also is working on developing new vaccines using the mRNA approach, and has worked with the chemistry department here to develop a new affordable nanolipid particle that is necessary for using mRNA vaccines. And they've patented that, and that may make it much cheaper, actually, to produce mRNA vaccines going forward. There are a variety of it. There's just to quickly mention that there's a group here that's called the Diagnostic and Innovation Hub, which is led by Wendy Stevens and Leslie Scott. And they're on the cutting edge of developing new diagnostic tests for infectious diseases and for cancer and for that link, and also for antimicrobial resistance, which is another big problem. And I could go on and on. The number of people here that are doing work that anyone would want to be associated with is huge.
Fantastic. Doc, we're going to take a quick ad break, but definitely something for South Africans to be proud of. We'll be back.
Thank you.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. It is the Dis-Chem Medical Monday. I'm joined in studio by the fantastic Dr. Robert Brayman, and we've been chatting about his research institute at Wits University on infectious diseases and oncology and their correlation. Doc, I wish we had 3 hours for this discussion. Just before we went to ads, we were saying the teams that are available here, the staff that are available here, the professionals in South Africa is something that we can really be proud of. And the institution as well. It looks like we may have lost the doctor on the live stream. Let us have your questions before we wrap up. Doc, you back? Okay, great.
Okay, good.
All right, got you back. Thank you. And I just want to say, it is something that we can be really proud of in South Africa with the quality of the personnel that we have. Just to ask a quick question, and I think obviously on everybody's mind, not to say is there a cure for what, when people talk about a cure for cancer, What is that? Because I think there are so many different varieties. How would you describe that, and how close are we to?
You're right. I mean, all of these cancers are different diseases and have different reasons that they occur. So there won't, at least in my lifetime, be a cure for all cancers.
Right.
But there is, you know, the research usually occurs in a vertical way focused on each specific cancer. And there has been great progress, particularly with immunotherapy for a variety of cancers that used to be 100% fatal that are doing better, much better now. But right now, they're very expensive. And so it's rare to see these kinds of cutting edge therapies that are improving 5-year survival dramatically here in Africa.
Right.
Which is part of why we're looking for ways to leapfrog over these incredibly expensive approaches with finding these new connections between infections and cancer. One of the things we're, particularly concerned about is colorectal cancer is occurring more and more in young people under the age of 50.
Sure.
So here from our VITS hospitals, looking at all the data, when you combine from all the hospitals, 26% of colorectal cancer is now occurring in people under 50. It used to be in the United States, for instance, that you wouldn't even recommend screening for colorectal cancer in people under 50 because the risk was so low. But it appears to be rising here and also in the United States and other places in Africa. And the question is why? You know, is what's the trigger for that? And so we're actively involved in ways to identify that trigger, because if we understand that, what's increasing the risk in younger people, maybe we can understand the risk in general and make a big dent in the severe burden from colorectal cancer.
Right. So what I'm hearing you say is that what the research is enabling you to do is to help people prevent rather than cure.
Prevention is always the first choice, if you can do that. And early diagnosis is sort of the second thing.
Right.
So one thing just to say quickly, the case fatality rate for cancer, or what you might say the incidence to mortality ratio, is too high in Africa.
Right.
And that's because people present here way too late and they don't get diagnosed early enough that you can do something about it.
Okay. So prevent, early detection, and those are the things
entry.
That we have on our side. And treat, absolutely.
Yeah.
Dr. Robert Brayman, Director of the new Infectious Disease and Oncology Research Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand. Thank you so much, Doctor. We greatly appreciated you having you on the show. Thank you for your time. And
thank you for having me, Nick.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us today on the Disco Medical Monday here on 101.9 High FM.